KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Don Gagne in steel towns that are happy about Japanese investment in U.S. steel. Then Harvard agrees to give back coarse photos that Tammy Lanier says are of her ancestors who were enslaved.
At the heart of this case is for museums to look at what you curate, to look at what you hold, and ask, should I be holding it? And what story should I be telling?
And later, Susan Choi's Siri new novel, Flashlight, and Benicio del Toro, who stars in Wes Anderson's new The Phoenician Scheme. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, May 31, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke today to a security conference in Singapore. He urged U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific to spend more on defense to counter a growing threat from China. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has more.
He said that China is intimidating and harassing its neighbors, including Taiwan. It's using gray zone tactics that are short of war but are coercive. And at the same time, he insisted that the U.S. does not seek to strangle or humiliate China, but he said that China's threat is real.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting from Singapore. President Trump says starting Wednesday, he's raising the tariffs on foreign steel from 25% to 50%. He also says that Nippon Steel has agreed to make a large investment in U.S. steel, which the Japanese steelmaker has been attempting to acquire. He said U.S. Steel will remain an American company. The U.S. Supreme Court handed President Trump a temporary win yesterday. It permitted the administration to prematurely end the humanitarian program that had granted two-year legal status to more than a half million people from Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Trump announced that he was ending the program on his first day in office this year, but a federal district court blocked the administration from doing that. The Justice Department then went directly to the Supreme Court, asking that the district court order be suspended while the litigation plays out in the lower courts. The High Court granted the Trump administration's wish for now. Karen Tumlin, co-counsel for the immigrants, fought back tears today as she described the effects of what she said was the largest mass deportation in the nation's history. These people, she said, played by the rules to enter the country legally. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The Texas legislature has approved a bill to spend $8.5 billion on schools. It now heads to Governor Greg Abbott for his signature. It would raise the basic student allotment for the first time since 2019. The Texas Newsroom's Blaze Ganey has more.
House Bill 2 includes $4.2 billion for teacher and staff pay raises with amounts based on experience and district size, up to $8,000 for some teachers. It also provides $1.3 billion to cover costs like insurance and utilities, $850 million for special education, including student evaluations, and $430 million for school safety upgrades like fencing and secure doors. The bill allows flexibility for public schools to begin offering full-day pre-K. While the basic allotment only increases by $55, most new funds are tied to specific uses. Supporters call it targeted and classroom-focused, while advocates say it could limit flexibility in spending for some districts. I'm Blaze Ganey in Austin.
This is NPR News in Washington. The United Nations nuclear watchdog says Iran has further increased its stockpile of uranium enriched to near weapons-grade levels. The International Atomic Energy Agency warned Iran to change course, saying its actions are of serious concern. The report comes as Iran and the U.S. are attempting to reach an agreement that Iran would curtail its nuclear activities in exchange for a relaxation of sanctions. Taylor Swift may be one of the biggest pop stars in the world, but for most of her career, she has not owned the masters for her first six albums. NPR's Hazel Sills reports that's changed.
It's common for singer-songwriters. Taylor Swift writes her songs, like one of her biggest hits, 2008's Love Story, and she sang it, but she didn't own it.
It's a love story, baby, just say yes.
But now, Swift has announced she finally owns her masters, nearly 6 years after music executive Scooter Braun first acquired them in 2019. That initial sale was the inspiration behind Swift releasing re-recordings of albums she didn't own the masters for, including her hit, Red. Swift did not disclose what she paid for the rights to her music. Hazel Sills, NPR News.
The Vienna Symphony Orchestra has performed the Blue Danube Waltz today to mark the 200th birthday of composer Johann Strauss. The European Space Agency will beam the performance into space to celebrate its 50th birthday. The piece has been considered a soundtrack to space after the film 2001: A Space Odyssey. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The steel mill just outside of Pittsburgh last night, President Trump applauded a potential deal between U.S. Steel Corporation and Japan's Nippon Steel, one that he says would bring billions in investment from the Japanese company.
And it includes vital protections to ensure that all steel workers will keep their jobs at all facilities in the United States will remain open and thriving.
Now, Trump had opposed the deal as a candidate, but now says it will be good for America and that U.S. Steel will still have an American CEO and a corporate board with a U.S. majority. But he was light on specifics and even admitted later there is no final deal. NPR's Don Gagne is in Pittsburgh. Don, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
What's the reaction in steel country?
I've been in and around Allegheny County these past couple days and in West Mifflin, where a key U.S. steel facility is located. So let's start there with the local mayor. His name is Chris Kelly.
What was your immediate reaction?
I started to cry. I mean, I've lived this for a year and a half, and I thought, wow, I wasn't expecting it.
And he made it clear they were tears of joy, he's talking.
Did the mayor talk about how his community had been hurt by the decline of U.S. Steel?
Yeah, he's lived it. He grew up in a nearby town where he says it was decades of decline. He says one mill after another closed and more than 200,000 jobs disappeared.
And I saw the devastation that came along with individuals losing their homes and their jobs, their cars, their families, you know, turned to drug abuse, eventually domestic violence. And I didn't want to see that.
And he sees the new investments from Nippon Steel as new life.
And what did people in the community tell you?
Most are only just learning some of the details, but it's welcomed. I met 55-year-old Malik Swain outside a local restaurant. He said it's good news, including what updating these old mills will mean for the environment.
I think it's good for the Mon Valley, actually. I think it's going to keep jobs there, grow it. They're also going to upgrade the facility. So I think that's a good thing as far as air quality goes, hopefully.
And Scott, I do want to note here that the United Steelworkers, the national union, has long been opposed to Nippon coming in, citing national security and allegations of unfair trade practices.
Of course, John, it's interesting that the president has really increased trade pressure on other countries. What do his supporters say about Nippon Steel, which is, after all, a Japanese company, potentially taking over a company that was once such a cornerstone of U.S. manufacturing?
And that was a big reason during the campaign last year that both candidate Trump and President Biden opposed this proposed deal with Nippon Steel. Now, though, such concerns seem to be overridden by the prospect of more jobs. But listen to this. I heard this from a local resident. His name is Mike Medich.
I'm glad it's Japan rather than China, because China has a lot of investments in our country, which I don't think they should have.
And I'll add here that Medich doesn't necessarily see this as a big engine for new jobs, but he says, had this mill closed, that would have been a real blow to the community.
And NPR's Don Gagne. Don, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
The civil war in Syria is over. Sanctions are being lifted. People who are on opposite sides are trying to come together to rebuild their country, but with difficulty. It can take time for attitudes to change, if they ever do. NPR's Lauren Frayer found these issues at play in a Damascus firehouse.
Every morning for 28 years, Haitham Nasrallah has opened his locker and put on his uniform as a firefighter. It's a job he loves, but a uniform he now hates. It marks him as a firefighter from the old regime of dictator Bashar al-Assad, who was ousted in December. Nasrallah recalls how some of his colleagues took off their uniforms and fled that day. But he stayed on, hoping for a firefighting job in the new Syria. And so he was still here in this cement block firehouse in southwest Damascus when 3 days after Assad's fall, a convoy rolled in from what was once rebel territory. Nasrallah says his first impression was just, wow, these guys had way better equipment. They were the White Helmets, volunteer first responders who won international fame for running into harm's way to rescue civilians in Syria's civil war. There was an Oscar-winning documentary about them. They operated for years on the opposite rebel side of the war, and they were demonized by the government. With the war over, the White Helmets are now taking over firefighting for all of Syria, which means the men Assad once called terrorists have suddenly moved into Nasrallah's barracks. When I visited, one of the White Helmets, Moaz Dawood, was frying up eggplant for a Ramadan iftar meal in the former regime guy's kitchen.
So some of the firefighters here worked for the regime, and you worked against the regime, and now you're having iftar together.
We're using their kitchen, he says, but we're not eating with them. There's actually a huge brick wall dividing their quarters. Veteran firefighters live on one side of the firehouse, and the White Helmets are on the other. When they first arrived, the White Helmets went room by room looking for weapons. At first, they looked at us with suspicion, a former regime firefighter Nasrallah says. Like we were behind Assad's bombings and killings. We have decades of firefighting experience, but they tried to sideline us, he says. They didn't see us as equals. The internationally funded White Helmets make 6 or 7 times the firefighters' salaries. And yet, every day, they've been responding to emergencies together.
Asking for telling the people to get ready and get clothed.
These are the fire poles, and there's 3 in a row, and one is for the first floor, one's for the second floor, and one comes all the way from the third floor. Oh yeah, here they come.
Sliding down fire poles from different rooms down into the same fire trucks. Out on a mission, I ask another of the former regime guys, Hussein al-Yassin, if he too feels like he has to prove his loyalty to the new Syria. And instead of answering, he just lifts up his shirt.
He was shot? He was stabbed?
No, this is from shrapnel.
And shows me and my producer, Jawad Rizallah, a huge scar across his belly from an attack he believes the old regime ordered against its own men. Some of the White Helmets look on, shake their heads, and mumble, respect. Over time, the White Helmets start inviting the former regime guys to work out with them, doing calisthenics in the yard and pumping iron in a basement strewn with barbells. But it takes us visiting and asking questions for the guys to open up with each other. The regime threatened us not to speak about how they treated us in prison, says 30-year-old Mohammed Khadir, who has braces on his teeth, slicked back hair, and sad eyes. It was his lifelong dream to be a firefighter. A year in, he was arrested by the regime that employed him. Someone denounced me, he says, accused me of being a terrorist. Me and my cousin both went to prison, and he died there under torture, Khadir says. He breaks down then, grabs my producer, Jawad, and hugs him. Staff here say 17 members of the Damascus Fire Department were imprisoned during the war, and 9 of them died behind bars. Khadir got out after 2.5 years, but was banned from returning to the fire department because of his record. The day the regime fell, though, in December, he rushed back to the job he loves. He describes guarding the fire station from vandalism that day. And he's been living and working here ever since, without taking a salary. The day after I hear his emotional story, I mention it to the White Helmets.
Did you know that there's a guy here who's working for free? He still doesn't have any salary.
One of the supervisors, a big bear of a man named Mustafa Bakar, with floppy hair and kind eyes, says, I don't know who this man is that you're talking about, who's been through so much, but he sounds like a hero. They live in the same firehouse, in fact, on the same floor, on opposite sides of a single brick wall, and they've never met. So, we introduce them.
He's saying Muhammad is our best friend here. He says, I've met him before, I didn't know this was Muhammad.
It turns out they do know each other. They just didn't know each other's names or what either one had been through. 10 years ago, Bakar had been wounded and rescued by the White Helmets and then joined them. This is like group therapy, Bakar says. I know him, I know Muhammad, but he never told me the things he told you.
When will they ever take down this wall between these two sides?
Soon, soon, they promise. That brick wall in this firehouse, between the old regime firefighters' living quarters and the new ones, it will come down. But there's still a psychological wall, Bakar says, and that may take some time. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, in the Kfar Susa Firehouse, Damascus.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. President Trump says he plans to double the tariffs on imported steel and aluminum from 25% to 50% to boost the steel industry in the U.S. He said the higher tariffs will take effect Wednesday. The drug company Moderna said today the Food and Drug Administration is approving its next-generation COVID vaccine. It said it's been approved for everyone age 65 and older and for those 12 to 64 who have at least one underlying risk factor. And officials in Nigeria now say at least 151 people died in flooding in a market town in the north-central part of the country. Heavy rain unleashed the floods earlier this week. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And it's time for sports. NHL is Stanley Cup rematch, NBA Finals. Oh, Oklahoma City awaits, but who'll join them? The Knicks or Pacers? Sports writer Howard Bryant joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, my friend. Listen, let's begin with hockey, because the Stanley Cup Final is going to be a rematch between the Florida Panthers, who want to be back-to-back champions, against the Edmonton Oilers, who want to be the first Canadian team to lift the Stanley Cup in 33 years. Which outcome do you think is more likely, ratification or revenge?
Don't do this to me. You know, I hate to make predictions. However, what I can tell you that both teams are playing great right now. This is exactly the matchup that I think that a lot of people wanted to see, considering that you do have the defending back-to-back champion, you know, you have the defending champions going up against a team that they beat last year after being up 3-0. Edmonton came back and won three in a row, and they had a game seven that went Florida's way. So now clearly both teams are motivated to do this whole thing again. And also when you're Edmonton, you've got the most exciting duo in hockey, Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl. They are terrific. And then the Panthers are the bruising Eastern Conference team. And who thought that we would be talking about hockey dynasties in Florida? First you had Tampa Bay, yes, and now you've got Florida. But it would be something I think that the Canadians would love to see in their beloved sport, a Canadian team finally win since the Montreal Canadiens won in 1993.
NBA playoffs, Oklahoma City Thunder clinched a spot in the finals by eliminating the Timberwolves in five games. They have looked great all year. They have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the newly crowned MVP. Is this just their moment?
Well, it might be their moment, and it might be their decade, considering how well they've put this team together. And I hate to say it, but, you know, shame on...
Just me.
We just don't talk about Oklahoma City enough because it's Oklahoma City. They have been dominant
all
season.
That's why I've been working
long
on this. Oh!
Exactly. Ahead, yeah. Something has to replace Cleveland Rocks. And so I feel like this is not a surprise. You look at the numbers, they should absolutely beat, you know, they should win the championship because their numbers have been historic. They've got SGA, who is the MVP, who is a terrific player. I think that the toughest challenge they had was when they came through Denver in the seven-game series. And we spent most of the season talking about the Los Angeles Lakers and Luka Doncic. So people don't want to have these conversations. But look, leave the small markets alone. Indiana is a very, very good basketball team. Oklahoma City is a great basketball team. And, of course, there's the Knicks that people want to see because the Knicks haven't won a championship since 1973. I think Indiana is obviously the favorite going home tonight to close out the Knicks. But the Knicks have been resilient. They beat the defending champion Celtics, and now they are a game away from forcing a game seven. But whatever the outcome is, I think there's a message here as well that there's a message here that the LeBron, KD, Steph Curry era is ending, and give a little respect to the SGA and the Oklahoma City Thunder. They are a great basketball team.
When the finals are over, I'm going to hate to say goodbye to NBA on TNT.
Yeah, same. The only show in sports where watching the pregame and the halftime and the postgame was exciting as the game itself. Legends, Barkley, Shaq, Ernie, and Kenny Smith, really going to miss it, losing a lot there, and end of an era. Very sad.
Yeah. Howard Bryant, thanks so much for being with us. Talk to you soon, my friend.
No, my pleasure, Scott.
California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom stirring things up by blaming local leaders for one of the state's most prominent problems, homelessness. 187,000 Californians experience homelessness, according to a federal count. And as Laura Fitzgerald of CAP Radio in Sacramento reports, this month's debate over who might be to blame comes with a price tag.
Governor Gavin Newsom has been noticeably frustrated over homelessness recently. He got people's attention with a message for city and county officials at a press conference a couple weeks ago.
Time to do your job. People are dying on their watch. Dying on their watch. How do people get reelected? Look at these encampments. They're a disgrace. They've been there years and years and years and years. I've heard that same rhetoric for years.
Since 2019, the state's provided grants for local governments to get people off the streets. But Newsom's recent budget proposal wouldn't renew these grants. The governor says he wants cities and counties to meet benchmarks for passing ordinances and increasing shelter capacity.
I'm not interested. I'm just not, as a taxpayer, not just governor, I'm not interested in funding failure anymore. I'm not.
Local leaders, including fellow Democrats, say finger-pointing doesn't help and that withholding funds will only make the crisis worse. Graham Knaus is CEO of the California State Association of Counties.
We certainly are not going to make progress if money is being clawed back from the only entities that are doing the primary work on the ground locally, and that's local government.
Some of the state's largest cities rely on state grants to increase beds in local shelters. Sacramento Mayor Kevin McCarty, a Democrat, says these grants account for around half of his city's homelessness budget.
One thing's clear. If you take that money away, there'll be more people on our streets.
This funding fight between Newsom and local officials comes as the state faces a budget deficit and the legislature faces tough choices before a deadline to pass a budget in mid-June. But some see an underlying political strategy at work here as Newsom confronts a homelessness issue that's damaged the state's reputation.
It's a very vulnerable weakness that the governor has as he positions himself nationally.
Mike Madrid is a Republican political consultant in Sacramento. He says California's homelessness crisis is one of Newsom's biggest political liabilities, especially if he decides to run for president in 2028.
And I think as the governor is realizing that outside of this state, he's going to have to either come up with a solution quick or he's going to have to fix the blame. If you can't fix the problem, fix the blame.
For unhoused people like Courtney Harris, who we met in an encampment, things are already tough enough.
We need water supply. If we're going to be out here, we need like soap. Supplies, because people are getting germs and getting sick out here.
Those kinds of things could be at stake as the political fight continues. For NPR News, I'm Laura Fitzgerald in Sacramento.
Harvard University this week agreed to give up ownership of two portraits believed to be the earliest photographs of enslaved black people in the United States. A Harvard biologist commissioned the portraits in 1850. They capture an older black man named Renty Taylor and his daughter, Delia Taylor. The university held on to the images, which have been at the center of a legal fight for ownership over the last 6 years. It was brought on by Tammy Lanier, who says she is the descendant of Renty and Delia. Tammy Lanier joins us now from Norwich, Connecticut. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Describe for us your relationship to Renty and Delia, because I understand records obviously can be difficult.
Yes, absolutely. Renty is my great-great-great-grandfather, and he is the father of Delia, which would make Delia my great-great-aunt. The daguerreotypes, the images, I actually encountered for the first time the image of Renty after hearing about him for my entire life from my mother, who shared with us our oral history. And in 2010, after the passing of my mom and with the help of a local ice cream shop owner, he discovered on the internet a picture of Papa Renty.
Could you tell us about that picture? It's been described as haunting.
Yes, and exactly my sentiments. Louis Agassiz and his scientific racism.
We should explain that. This was a Harvard biologist who had a theory of I'll get you to explain it.
Scientific racism. He theorized that blacks were a separate, lesser species, suggesting because of this inferiority, black people need to be enslaved. At a time when the question of slavery was being hotly debated, this is a premier scientist of his day. Originally from Europe, he was born in Switzerland, and Harvard courted him. And when he arrived to the United States, he encountered a black person for the first time and believed them to be subhuman. And we know this because he wrote this in a letter to his mother. He traveled to South Carolina, where my enslaved ancestors toiled. He, in addition to Rindy and Delia, there were five other enslaved people who were photographed in the nude, who were poked and prodded. And it was a grueling process. And these daguerreotypes were created to give ocular proof of the stark differences between the black and white race.
What can you tell us about Rinty and Delia Taylor?
They were amazing people. The oral history about Papa Rinty was that he was a person of excellence, that he was an educator, that he taught himself to read using Noah Webster's Blueback Speller. He would teach anyone to read if they had a desire to read, is what my mom said. And he did this at his own peril.
May I ask, what moves through you when you take a look at those photographs now?
When I look at Delia, I was always moved by the historical account that Delia cried during this experience. There's books that have been written, Delia's Tears, written by Molly Rogers, where she talks about the inhumanity of the experience. And Delia's only act of passive resistance was to cry. I always wondered what became of Delia. For Rinty, when I look at him, I see the stubborn man that his oral history has proclaimed him to be. I see a man who is communicating with me, messaging me, get me out of this circumstance.
Harvard University has said in a statement they were, I'm going to quote, not able to confirm that you are a descendant of Rinty and Delia Taylor.
I'm glad you bring that up. They've never sat with me and looked at my genealogy. The basis of my claim is grounded in official government records, probate wills, cemetery records, slave indexes, birth certificates, death records, land records.
I gather you have met with the great-great-great-granddaughter of the Harvard biologist.
Yes, from the moment I talked to them, we bonded. They have been so supportive of me, and I tried to be very supportive of them, and we've worked on campaigns together, we've traveled together, and we're sisters.
Tammy, what happens to the photographs now that Harvard's given them up?
They are going to go to Charleston, South Carolina, to the International Afro-American Museum there. South Carolina is the state where this all began, where Rinty, Delia, and the other enslaved people lived and died and are buried. And so I view this as a repatriation, homegoing ceremony. And what's important about this museum, they have clean hands.
Is this settlement justice in your mind?
I believe it's justice for every descendant of American chattel slavery. An example of reparations, a descendant to say, you have wrongfully expropriated my ancestors' cultural or intellectual or personal property, and I, as the descendant, want it back. It's a victory for ethical stewardship, because at the heart of this case is for museums to look at what you hold and ask, should I be holding it? And what story should I be telling?
Tammy Lanier, she also has a book, From These Roots, My Fight with Harvard to Reclaim My Legacy. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. England has long been seen as the home of modern soccer. Football. But now their old rival Scotland disagrees. Jed O'Brien is a sports historian and founder of the Scottish Football Museum in Glasgow, and he claims to have discovered the world's oldest soccer field, and it's in southern Scotland. He joins us now. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What makes you sure, Mr. O'Brien, that this is a football field, soccer as we call it here, and not just, you know, a big meadow?
A series of amazing coincidences, Scott. First off, it's a field which has no use because the land was so poor. Next coincidence, it's about half a mile south of a new Presbyterian church, Anwath Kirk, that had been built in 1627. Another coincidence, Samuel Rutherford, who is actually a famous Protestant theologian, it was one of his first places where he ministered. So this is a man who was seriously anti-soccer. It is recorded that his parishioners on a Sunday would either go into the church and then go out to this field in Anwath, or they would not go to church at all. And he was serious about bringing everyone to God. So eventually he snapped and headed off to remonstrate with them that they weren't doing as they should do. And the fact that I know exactly where it is, thanks to Archaeology Scotland, is when he went out to remonstrate with his parishioners, he swore by the witnesses that were the Rutherford stones, which were prehistoric, prehistory stones, which allowed me to exactly identify where the field was.
Part of the dispute, as I understand it, about who invented modern soccer depends on how you define the game, because there was a sport called mob football, wasn't there, played in the British Isles?
That absolutely drives me nuts. The game, as far as I can see, was an excuse to punch the guy in the next parish who you didn't like. How can this game possibly have any link to the game the Scots perfected in the 1870s and 80s, where you have 22 players on a pitch? And of course, the answer is it has no link. The link is from places like Anwath playing regular football every Sunday, running through the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries until modern football really started, I guess, in 1872 with the world's first international.
As I don't have to tell you, I'm sure at international tournaments, there, you know, Scotland and England are both represented. Should Scotland fans now start singing "It's Coming Home" when the game is going their way?
Absolutely. And when there have ever been international tournaments in England and they do the "Football's Coming Home," I will always tell people I must have fallen asleep and missed all the Glasgow games. What's happened is the history of, in my case, football in Scotland has either been smothered or stolen wholesale and has become the history of football in England.
Jed O'Brien is founder of the Scottish Football Museum in Glasgow. Thanks very much. Good season to you, sir.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Danny and Michael Filippo create horror movies that critics love and make audiences scream. And that's the way they like it.
I love that it's scaring people as well as touching them. That feels so incredible.
Their new movie, Bring Her Back, and all the latest news Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. Touch my body
tender. We'll be right back.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the threat from China is real and could be imminent. He spoke today in Singapore at a forum for defense leaders and diplomats from the Indo-Pacific, urging them to spend more on defense. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the U.S. nuclear watchdog, issued a report today that Iran has further increased its stockpile of uranium enriched to near weapons-grade levels. Iran has maintained its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. And the biggest match in European soccer takes place today in Munich. Paris Saint-Germain and Inter Milan compete in the Champions League's final. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Susan Choi's new novel opens in mystery and tragedy. Louisa, 10-year-old girl, and her father, Cirque, walk along a beach in Japan. He carries a flashlight. We next see Louisa when she is washed up by the tide, struggling to breathe. Her father is gone. He couldn't swim. What happened? What will unfold next for the family? And what might we miss in our own life stories? Flashlight is Susan Choi's novel. And Susan Choi, a National Book Award winner who has taught creative writing at Yale, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Help us understand all that weighs on Louisa to awake to be alive, but also to have suffered a profound loss and a persisting question.
Well, she doesn't know even the biggest part of what's happened to her. We meet her at the beginning of the book after these events that you've just described. She and her mother are left to their own after something really terrible, and it does not bring them closer together, at least not for a very long time.
When she is speaking to a psychiatrist, at one point she says, "I don't want friends. I don't like people asking me questions."
She does her best to fend off this child psychiatrist. She's very unreceptive to him. But at the same time, she kind of can't help engaging with him, even as she's sort of trying to fend him off. I hope the reader realizes that she's going to so much trouble to fend off this guy because she's actually terribly lonely. She does want to talk to somebody, and she does end up talking to him, saying more to him than she ever meant to. She kind of can't help it.
This is a family, I think we might put it this way, these days, with many strands. Cirque, her father, for example, is an ethnic Korean born and raised in Japan.
Cirque's born of this fascination that I actually had with all of the tensions that exist between Korea and Japan historically, which I've written about before. I've been fascinated by, you know, my own father and grandfather come out of this history of Japan making Korea a colony and then having to give up the Korean colony with the end of World War II. I was so interested in what was going on with ethnic Koreans who kind of got washed up in Japan at the end of World War II. They were second-class citizens under this Japanese empire, but then there is no Japanese empire, and they're citizens of nothing. And my interest in, you know, what was that like kind of led to my inventing this character who grows up in this situation where he really doesn't have a country.
You, in interviews, in fact, you've called Louisa's family, I think, mark this down, your phrase is an alternate universe family for your own, right?
Very alternate. My own family spent some time in Japan when I was young. I was Louisa's age. I was interested both in that experience that I had when I went to Japan as this confused, I'd grown up in the Midwest and no one ever looked like me. My dad's Korean and my mom isn't. So We went to Japan and I was sort of expecting to like fit in brilliantly and, I don't know, be received with glory, you know. At last, here you are, a person who looks like us. And of course, I didn't look like anybody there either. Japan cast a dark shadow, and I think that Korea-Japan relationship was something I wanted to explore in this slightly different way.
Such a vast historical expanse over this novel of almost a century, you know, and for that matter, the hereafter. I've got an intensely practical question. How do you keep so many characters and their stories going in your mind? How do you keep them straight?
I began this novel with the intention of writing something very short. And I feel like the novel kind of wrote itself like a snail shell. It just kept spiraling outward in both directions. I had a hard time keeping track of it, to be honest. And at some point, I had this revelation, which I'm going to share now with your listening audience as an amazing tip. I decided to put the events in chronological order.
Wow, that's Tolstoyan.
I know. It's a major narrative discovery. When you put the events in order, it's easier to keep track of what happened. I offer this free of charge.
Well, thank you. Boy, you wind up with complicated feelings for Louisa. She almost blows up a college trip that veers from comedy to near disaster.
She is only slightly less difficult as a young adult than she is as a child. I think there's a lot of me in Louisa, admittedly. It's a hard thing to admit because she's a character that is so committed to fending off love. But it was so important to me that she find love and some kind of peace. And that's why we end up following her for many, many decades and many, many pages. But I think she gets there. I hope she gets there.
There is a line that I have savored. Love is perhaps the sensation of expertise that erupts out of nowhere, and as time goes on, accumulates enough soil at its feet as to be standing on something.
I'm glad you singled out that line. It's funny, I remember where I was sitting when I wrote that. I was sitting in this wonderful library in Seattle looking out at the water, and I was trying to figure out how to talk about that love and that sensation of recognizing someone that you really actually don't know at all. And I guess this is sort of about the flashlight again and what we can see and what we can't see. I think sometimes the experience of falling in love is this experience of believing that we know everything about someone that actually we've only just met, and our conviction that they belong to us and that we belong to them binds us to them. And if we do that successfully, we end up learning things.
Susan Choi's new novel, Flashlight. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me and for your wonderful reading.
Voters head to the polls tomorrow in Mexico, and new on the ballot will be judges, nearly 880 on the federal bench alone. And if you live in one of the 19 of the country's 32 states with local judges up for election, that's hundreds of more choices to make. Democracy in action, well, scholars say,
Mexico is just returning to the old days of the authoritarian regime.
Mexico's massive election day later today on All Things Considered. You can tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Jaja Cord has been thinking about his own death. Not unexpected after the international tycoon has survived 6 assassination attempts and counting. The protagonist of the new Wes Anderson movie, The Phoenician Scheme, is ruthless and grandiloquent.
I've appointed you sole heir to my estate, which you may come into sooner rather than later.
Why? It's been 6 years since our last meeting.
I have my reasons.
Which are what?
My reasons? I'm not saying. I'm not saying.
He's the kind of mid-century anti-hero you might have seen once played by Orson Welles. But after so many attempts on his life, does Zsa Zsa begin to soften? Benicio del Toro plays the injured and often black-eyed Zsa Zsa Korda. He joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wes Anderson has said that he wrote this character for you, and you collaborated.
Well, I collaborated in the fact that, you know, Wes, first of all, he never said he was writing a part for me. This movie was a movie for me. He said he wanted me to be part of this story. And it happened that I was the lead. So little by little, he first sent me the first 20 pages. Then he sent me 40 pages. And I would have questions and thoughts.
What did you want to put into this character of Zsa Zsa Korda?
Well, I tell you what, I wanted to make sure that you know, he's got an incredible arc. Where the character ends is not really where he begins, you know? So when you have a character that has an arc like that, you just want to make sure that that transition is going to be believable, that he would become maybe a better person at the end. And I believe that when I saw the film that it is there, we believe that this character could become who he becomes at the end, mostly thanks to his daughter's influence.
How do you keep a straight face when you're playing a character in a Wes Anderson film? Some of the most extraordinary, absurd situations, and yet you play them deadpan.
Well, you know, Wes wants you to be honest, and he never said to me, I want you to be funny. He wanted me to play it real. Even if something was completely absurd, you know, play it like it's real. And don't go for the laugh. And if it's real, the laughs will follow. And so basically, I just try to play it as honest and as try to be in the moment and not get, you know, there were a lot of laughs on the set, but maybe not in front of the camera. In front of the camera, I try to stay as serious as possible so that maybe the laugh could follow.
What's it like to be in a Wes Anderson film? I mean, so many big names, as there are in this one, cutting up and yet keeping a straight face. Is it fun?
It's a lot of fun. Listen, like, I started in this world of movies as a fan. You know, so working with Bryan Cranston and Tom Hanks or Scarlett Johansson or Bill Murray or Willem Dafoe, Jeffrey Wright or Riz Ahmed or Mia Threapleton, that's part of the security blanket that you get for being in a Wes Anderson film. You're going to be working with the best talent, and they're going to make you better, really. They made everyone better.
Yeah. I have read you had a brief life as a business major and then found the theater.
I don't know how brief that was. When they asked me what did I want to do, I just put business because I don't know. I just felt like I had to put something. But then I changed it to drama when I took an acting class. And it was the first time that I don't come from a family of theater or film. So it was the first time that I realized that this drama thing is something that you can actually study it. There's a logic to it. So that's when I realized, like, oh, there's room for improvement. That's when I decided to go into drama.
What do you think clicked with you in drama?
Maybe you could perhaps show something that I knew about life, present it. Everyone's life is different, you know, and I could show something about the way I experienced my life. I don't know an example to it, but there was something about that. There was something about expressing yourself. There was something about saying something beyond your lines.
You could, with your performance, you can say something.
Yes, with your performance, with your actions. Yes, even with your wardrobe.
We're living in a world that has, I'll be careful with my language here, a lot of craven international business figures who have enormous power. Do you think they might learn something from Zsa Zsa's example?
Sure, why not? Yes. I also like to add that it's been like that for, I don't know, since the Egyptians. But I think they can. I think, hell, I can learn something from Zsa Zsa.
Benicio del Toro stars in the new Wes Anderson film, The Phoenician Scheme. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ngozi Wathiong'o went to jail for writing a play in his mother tongue, Gikuyu. During his year in prison, he wrote his first novel on toilet paper. Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, Kenya's celebrated novelist and playwright, died on Wednesday at the age of 87. We were fortunate to speak with Mr. Ngugi back in 2020. His book, The Perfect Nine, had just been published in English, and he told us the time in prison had changed him as a writer.
How come that a post-colonial African government has put me in prison for writing in an African language? So why now? And that question is what set in motion my thinking about an unequal relationship of power between languages. That thinking made me say, no, from now onwards, I'll be writing in my mother tongue. And that's how I came to write my first novel in the Ikoyo language called Devil on the Cross. I wrote it on the only paper available to me, which was toilet paper.
Ratana's life forced Ngugi to spend much of his life in exile. He taught comparative literature at the University of California, Irvine for many years, but he continued to write in his mother tongue and then translated his works into English. He believed that only works written in an indigenous language could truly be called African. For many years, Ngugi's name came up as a favorite to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. He told us about the night reporters were at his house at 3 a.m., waiting outside for the call from Sweden.
So when the news came, my wife had to let them in and really consoled them because they were still more depressed than we were. But my wife made them coffee. That was actually quite amusing, yeah.
Ngugi never did win the Nobel Prize, but he achieved something equally important.
I really appreciate what I call the Nobel of the heart. Somebody reads my book and they come and tell me, look, your book impacted me in this and that manner. The beauty about the Nobel of the heart is it's very democratic. Is available to every writer.
Poet, playwright and novelist Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, and winner of the Nobel Prize of the Heart. He spoke with us back in 2020. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Walking up the street, acting big and bold, but deep down in my pockets, I had no gold. Was looking kind of sad when before my eyes was a $1 million bill that must have fell out the skies. I said, hey now, hey now.
Hey!